This is a shiur that I give every year on the mechanics of halacha and how it works. Okay, so some of the greatest confusion that we have in halacha, so when we have a question about halacha, generally doesn't apply to the actual halacha itself that we're learning, but rather the mechanics of how the halacha was developed. And a lot of times, if you have clarity in the actual halacha, the mechanics of the halacha works, then you'll be able to understand the particular halacha that you're confused by. Okay, so we're going to start all the way from the beginning and go through the mechanics of halacha, and we should have enough time. Okay, so the first question we have to ask ourselves is what was Moshe given? What was Moshe taught at Har Sinai? Right, Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to Har Sinai, and that's where he's given the Torah. Okay, so he's given two types of Torah. Every question to write down the question and the notes, or at least just write the answer down in a complete sentence. So at Har Sinai, Moshe was taught two parts of the Torah. Okay, the Torah can be divided into two parts: into Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh, right? The oral Torah and the written Torah. Okay. What was the Torah Shebichtav that Moshe learned? So it couldn't have been a Sefer Torah, right? Sometimes we have this image of Moshe Rabbeinu sitting at Har Sinai and writing out a Sefer Torah, right? And then he comes down, and we don't know where that Sefer Torah goes because he only comes down with the Luchos, with the tablets, right? So that's impossible, right? And there are, most importantly, there are incidents that haven't happened yet. Right, there are things that haven't happened yet. Had Moshe, right, the biggest example is that had Moshe known ahead of time a certain incident, he for sure would have changed how the things happened. For instance, hitting the rock, right? So if Moshe Rabbeinu had known about hitting the rock, right, that would have prevented him from going into Eretz Yisrael. When the time came for him to talk to the rock, he would have talked to the rock very nicely. He would have said, "Oh, I remember at Har Sinai, I hit the rock, right? That was the narrative. So now let's change the future." Okay, so that's so for sure, Moshe Rabbeinu was not writing down a Sefer Torah like we have today. Rather, Moshe learned the 613 mitzvos and the narrative that occurred until that point. Okay, and he transcribed what God told him to write down. That's a general consensus point that most people agree to. Okay, that Moshe learned the 613 mitzvos and their details, right, and the narrative that had occurred until that point. Okay, so sitting on Har Sinai, that's what Moshe Rabbeinu learns of the Torah Shebichtav. Okay, now there are two types of laws. If we talk about the Torah has a narrative to it and it also has laws, there are two types of laws that are in the Torah. Okay, the first law that you have is the 613 mitzvos. Okay. What's the significance of the 613 mitzvos? Right, if you go through the Torah and count up the commands, right, so you're going to see if every time you write down that it says God commanded Moshe to do this, or God commanded Bnei Yisrael to do like this, so you're going to have many more than 613 directives, right, and 613 commands, right? It says don't do avodah zarah. It says at least 38 times in the Torah. So you're going to have, right, so that's not 38 different mitzvos. The 613 mitzvos are main categories. Okay, those are main categories of mitzvos, and all laws must fit into those categories. Okay, that's the first type of law, and then you have Torah laws. Okay, what we call dinei d'oraisa. Those are not part of the Tariag. Those are not part of the 613 mitzvos, but those are subcategories. Okay, so they don't qualify as one of the 613 mitzvos, but they are mitzvos in the Torah. Those are mitzvos that on a Torah level that one must keep. They're given to by God just like he gave the Tariag mitzvos. And those are the two types of laws that we have in the Torah. Okay? So when we talk about Moshe Rabbeinu having the Torah Shebichtav and learning the Torah Shebichtav on Har Sinai, the written Torah, so part of the written Torah are laws, part of it are narrative. The laws in the Torah can be divided into two types, Tariag mitzvos and Dinei d'oraisa. Okay? Okay. Now, those Dinei d'oraisa and the Tariag mitzvos can be broken into three categories. Okay, we're familiar with these categories. Well, the first one is mitzvos aseh, right? Those are mitzvos that you must do, right? Commands, things, actions that you must take, thoughts that you must have, things you must say. Okay, those are mitzvos aseh. That's the Torah says you must do something. The second category are things that you're forbidden from doing. Okay. So it could be things that you're not allowed to actively do, things you're not allowed to say, things you're not allowed to think. Right? Those are mitzvos lo ta'aseh. And the third category that we find in Torah Shebichtav are philosophical lessons. These are not things that are obligatory to do. They're not commands, you must do this. But they're philosophical ideas that lend to man's improvement, to man's perfection. Okay? So, for instance, I'll give an example of each one. An example of a mitzvah sase is to say the Shema. An example of a mitzvah lo tase is don't speak Lashon Hara. An example of a philosophical lesson, okay, would be doing mitzvahs with excitement and enthusiasm. Right? That's something that the Torah says to do. Yet there's no Taryag mitzvah, not one of the 613 mitzvahs, and there's no mitzvahs lo tase, right? But rather, the Torah, when it says to do each mitzvah in an enthusiastic, passionate, excited fashion, is saying that as a philosophical lesson. So you have, in the Torah Shebichtav, you have two parts of the Torah Shebichtav. You have the narrative and you have the mitzvahs. Within the mitzvahs, you have two types of mitzvahs. You have the 613 mitzvahs and the Torah laws. Within the Torah laws, right, you have mitzvahs ase, mitzvahs lotase, and philosophical lessons. So let's move on to Torah Shebaal Peh. Okay? What are the three things that Torah Shebaal Peh includes? Okay? So the first thing that Torah Shebaal Peh includes, now what's Torah, first of all, what's Torah Shebaal Peh? Torah Shebaal Peh are things that Moshe was not supposed to write down. Okay? These are things that Moshe was not supposed to write down. They were not going to be published widely. You can't publish this widely, okay? They can be, you can write your own notes, okay? That's it's a misnomer to think that it's forbidden to write down anything for the Torah Shebaal Peh, but they were not allowed to be published and publicized in written form, okay? So Torah Shebaal Peh has three categories. They have laws, okay? Actual laws, okay? So they could be, let's say, an explanation of one of the 613 mitzvahs, but it's an actual law that we find in Torah Shebaal Peh. So an example of that would be that your tefillin must be black. Okay? So that's not one of the Taryag mitzvos, right? And you're not going to find in the Torah where it says your tefillin should be black. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu was told at Har Sinai that all tefillin should be black, and that he taught that. If somebody says, well, Moshe, where's that written? So his answer is, that's Torah Shebaal Peh. Okay? The second part of Torah Shebaal Peh, this is where this is a focus on this, is the method of deriving the laws from the Torah. Okay, these are what we call the hermeneutic principles, right? Amidos haTorah nidreshes bahem. These are like principles, right? These are methods that we derive a law. So, for instance, kal v'chomer, gzera shava, right? These are laws. They say, okay, how do we find what the law is here? So we can learn the law the following ways. So we're not given a direct pasuk. We're not given a direct law. Rather, the rabbis were instructed. Moshe Rabbeinu was instructed, and he gave that method over to the scholars of those of each generation, where they had a system, a method of deriving laws from the Torah. So an example would be, it says that you can't cook a kid in its mother's milk, right? So what do we learn now? What do we learn from that? Right? We learn three different prohibitions. We learn a prohibition of eating meat and milk together, cooking meat and milk together, and benefiting from meat and milk together. Right? Those are the three prohibitions we learn. Now, how did we learn those? Right? It doesn't say that anywhere. So how did we learn those yisurim? So the rabbi said, oh, it says that same pasuk, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, right? It says that three times. From the three times, it's repetitive, unnecessarily so, and therefore there must be a separate iser, a separate prohibition learned from each one of those repeated psukim. Okay, so since it says it three times, right? So those are the three things. The third part of Torah Shebaal Peh that we learn are principles. Okay, these are principles that apply throughout the entire Torah, but they are not limited to one mitzvah. So I'll give you two examples of a principle that applies to many, many mitzvot that does not apply. It does not learn from one specific mitzvah. One is Tadir Rishena Tadir Tadir Kodem. Right? If I have a conflict between doing two different mitzvahs, and I'm not sure which mitzvah I should do, so the one that comes more frequently takes precedence. That's not a law, let's say, in Rosh Chodesh. That's not a law in Shabbat. That's not a law in Talit, right? What is that a law in? That's a principle that applies throughout many different things. Okay. The second example is mitzvah saseishas man grama nashim eina chayavas behen. Right. That when it comes to a mitzvah that's time generated, right. Let's say it's dependent on time. So shofar blowing, sukkah. Right. Women are not obligated in that mitzvah. That's not a halacha in sukkah. It's not a halacha in shofar. It's a principle that applies throughout many different things. So just to sum up on Torah Shabbat Peh, there are three parts of Torah Shabbat Peh: actual laws, the method by which we derive laws, and principles that apply throughout the Torah to many different mitzvahs. So let's review what Moshe Rabbeinu learned. Okay? Moshe Rabbeinu learned Torah Shebichtav, and he learned Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebichtav, right, had two parts to it, right? Sorry, Torah Shebichtav, right, Torah Shebichtav had two parts. It had the narrative and it had the laws, okay? Then it had, there's two types of laws there in the Torah, right, in Torah Shebichtav. There is the Taryag Mitzvos, there's the 613 Mitzvos, and then you have the Torah laws, Mitzvos D'Oraisa, Torah level laws, which are subcategories. The 613 mitzvahs are the categories. If you picture it, right? If you would have what I like to imagine in my mind is a very large wall that goes on for miles. Okay, and each slab of concrete that makes up like vertically, right, like one of the parts of the wall. Okay, so you imagine like a vertical part of the wall, vertical part of the wall, right, vertical part of the wall, and they're put together. If each one of those is the 613 mitzvos, each slab is its own one of the 613 mitzvos. So those are categories. Everything that we learn has to fit into one of those categories. So a Torah law that we have is not going to be a new slab of concrete. It's not going to be a new tab on your computer. It's going to be instead, right, it's not a new folder. It fits into one of the Taryag mitzvos. Okay, got it. That's how it would work. And then you have mitzvos within those 613 mitzvos and Torah laws. You have mitzvos asay, you have mitzvos los asay, you have philosophical lessons. Okay, those are right. That's then you have in the Torah Shabbat Peh, you have laws, right? Actual laws that we don't find in the Torah. Then you have the method of deriving the laws, and then you have principles that apply throughout the entire Torah. So what Moshe Rabbeinu learned at Har Sinai was part one. Okay, that's what he learned at Har Sinai. That's what we have. Those are all Torah level laws. Those are things that we don't, that it's very hard for us to change, if at all, right? We can't change those. Usually if there's any doubt about those things, about any of those laws, we're stringent because they're God-given, right? So they're not things that we can mess with, okay? Part two of this, what we're going to look at in the mechanics of halacha, are rabbinic laws. Okay, and rabbinic laws are designed to protect the Torah. Okay, they're designed first and foremost to protect the Torah. Okay, so now the main question that we have to have is, well, how do rabbis come along and create laws? How is that possible? How can a rabbi come along and create a law? So that's going to be our meta question in this section. But what we have to be able to do is understand what exactly a rabbinic law is before we can understand how it could be instituted. Okay, so what's the purpose of a mitzvah derabbanan? Mitzvah derabbanan means a rabbinic law. Okay, that's our so the what's the purpose of the mitzvah derabbanan? Right, it's to ensure, and one meta answer, it's to ensure the observance of the mitzvahs d'oraisa, that the Torah laws are observed. Okay, and the Torah, in order to give enforcement to the rabbinic laws, one of the Torah mitzvahs, one of the Taryag mitzvahs that God said is that we must listen to the rabbis. Okay, so there's a group, a legislative body that's given the power. It's not just any rabbi can come along and make a law, but there's a legislative body based in Haggadah, Sanhedrin, right? Actually, I guess it's Hagdola. In each generation, it had a different name. But that body of rabbis, that authoritative body, are given the command from God to create methods and commands, laws, to ensure the observance of the mitzvahs d'oraisa. Okay? Got it? Okay. So who's authorized to legislate mitzvahs d'rabbanan? Who's allowed to give these mitzvahs d'rabbanan, right? So that's the Sanhedrin, right? Sanhedrin is allowed to and authorized to make mitzvahs d'rabbanan, to create mitzvahs d'rabbanan, to legislate and create new laws, okay? And who authorized them to do this? Right? God did, right? God gives the authorization to the rabbis to create mitzvahs. If God didn't give the authorization to the rabbis, then who could have? Right? If the whole system that we follow of the Torah, we follow it because it has divine authority, that's the whole reason why we follow the Torah, right? Not just because it's a good law book that we like better than the American Constitution. We follow it because it's divinely given. So therefore, if somebody comes along and says, I'm going to create a law within this system of laws, we'd have to say, well, you need divine permission to do so. And you find that, right? You find that listed in the Torah, okay? Now, just like Torah laws, there are different types of rabbinic laws, okay? There isn't one type of rabbinic law. We take rabbinic laws and we can divide them into four different parts, okay? So if you're taking notes on this, you'd want to write down, right, four different types of rabbinic laws, okay? So just like you wrote down, there are two types of Torah Shebaal Peh laws, which can then be divided into three, and then Torah Shebichtav can be divided into three different types. Torah Shebaal Peh, excuse me, can be divided into three parts as well. When it comes to rabbinic laws, there are four types of rabbinic laws, okay? The first type of rabbinic law are takanos, okay? What are takanos? Takanos are things that the rabbis tell us we must do. Okay, and we must do them because they enhance the fulfilling of the Torah. Okay, so an example of a takana derabanan is kiddush on Shabbat morning. Okay, we're not obligated to make kiddush on Shabbat morning from the Torah law, right? We have an obligation of zachor es yom haShabbos l'kodesho to sanctify the Shabbos day. That occurs when Shabbos starts, right? That's our Friday night kiddush. Shabbos morning, there was no kiddush. The rabbi said, what's going to separate our Sunday lunch from our Shabbos lunch? Right? Well, how do they look any different? So the answer is they look different because there is Kiddush. We're going to set the meal on a cup of wine and make Kiddush. So now we have Shabbos morning, we have Kiddush. That's a takana derabanan. That's the rabbis come along, and you can look through the entire gamut of the Torah. You will not find in the Torah Shebaal Chatav, nor in the Torah Shebaal Peh, you will not find a law that you must make Kiddush Shabbos morning. Okay? That's the rabbis coming along on their own, taking a vote and saying, we have this idea. They're not deriving it from the Torah. There's no pasuk that they point to and say, oh, we see from here that we should be making Kiddush Shabbos morning. This is their own idea. Okay? And we are obligated to follow it because we're obligated to follow all mitzvot derabanan because God says you must follow mitzvot derabanan. Okay? The second type of a mitzvot derabanan is a gzeira. Okay? An gzeira is an action that the rabbis prohibit in order to make sure that we don't come close to breaking the Torah, okay, to violating a law of the Torah, a prohibition of the Torah. So an example of that, according to some, although this is not everybody agrees that that muksa is a gzeira, but muksa, right, where I can't move an object that object has no purpose, and therefore I would violate Shabbos by using that object. So an example would be, right? I'm not allowed to write from the Torah law, I'm not allowed to write on Shabbat. I can't take a pen and write something on Shabbat. So is from the Torah law, though, there's no problem with me moving a pen on Shabbat, right? I could take a pen to shul with me on Shabbat. I could keep it in my lapel, right? It looks good. I keep it in my lapel pocket because it's a gold pen. I'm not violating any Torah law. But the rabbis came along and said, what's going to end up happening? You're going to forget that you are not allowed to write on Shabbat. Somebody's going to tell you something you want to remember. You have the pen there. You take out the pen and you write it down. And whoops, I violated Shabbat that way. So the rabbis came along and said, if the object has no purpose on Shabbat, right, so then now it's what we call muksa. It's set aside for use not on Shabbat. And therefore, I can't use it. I can't move it on Shabbat. It's not that I'm not allowed to touch it. That's a misnomer. But I'm not allowed to move it on Shabbat. That's not, the rabbis did not look into the Torah and say, oh, you see from this pasuk and the way this pasuk's written that there's something called muksa. Right? Not true. There's absolutely no Torah source to muksa. Good? Got it? Okay. The third type of rabbinic law, third type of mitzvah derabanan, is minhag. Now, this isn't the minhag that we talk about when, like, oh, I sit for Kiddush and you stand for Kiddush. That's my family minhag. That's not what we're referring to. This is a minhag that the rabbis instituted. It's called a minhag midarabanan. This is the true, right, not the colloquial use of the word minhag, but the true use of the word minhag. And what this means, this is like an action. What separates a minhag from a takana is that a takana was started by the rabbis. The discussion was started within the Sanhedrin. a minhag differently was started by a community. The Sanhedrin was alerted to, hey, this community is doing this. And then they say, you know what, that's actually a very good idea. Let's bring that to the rest of Bnei Israel. But we're going to institute it as a minhag, not as a takara. So an example, okay, an example, and then I'll show you a practical difference between a takana and a minhag. An example of a minhag is halal on Rosh Chodesh. We are not obligated to say halal on Rosh Chodesh. There's no Torah law that says that we have to say halal on Rosh Chodesh. But there was a community, the Gemara in Pesachim talks about, that was saying halal on Rosh Chodesh in order to show that Rosh Chodesh was special, right? So the rabbis walked into this community. They saw that they were saying halal on Rosh Chodesh, and they said, what are you doing? We don't say halal on Rosh Chodesh. So we wanted to show that it was special. Well, you can't just do that. You can't just start saying halal. In fact, the Gemara in Shabbat talks about how you're not allowed to say halal every day, so it would actually be a violation. They said, oh, what we do, though, is we say a half halal. Right, we say a half halal. We don't do the full halal, right? Because doing the full halal would be a violation of that problem of saying halal every day. So we do a half halal. The rabbi saw that and said, "Great." Sephardic custom, as opposed to Ashkenazic custom, is that if you have a minhag, you don't make a bracha on it. Okay, so a takana, we do make a bracha, right? An example of a takana derabanan is Megillah on Shabbat. Right? I'm sorry, Megillah on Purim. Right? Lighting Hanukkah candles. We make brachos on those. Right? The bracha that we make a bracha on it. But Sephardim do not make a bracha on a minhag. So you'll know the difference if something is a takana and a minhag is if whether or not Sephardim are making a bracha on it. So Sephardim do not make a bracha on halal on Rosh Chodesh. Right? Sephardim don't make a bracha on halal on Rosh Chodesh because it's a minhag, not a takana. They do obviously make a bracha on lighting candles on Hanukkah and reading the Megillah on Purim because that's a takana, not a minhag. The fourth type of mitzvah derabanan, okay, this is our fourth type, is just like we had it with the Torah, you have a philosophical lesson where the rabbis tell us an idea that helps us improve ourselves as people, right? Helps us perfect ourselves, but it's not obligatory, okay? So an example are most of the lessons in Pirkei Avot, right? Most of the things you see in Pirkei Avot, right, that I never found anything better for me than silence, right, is an example, right? So there's no command that you should be quiet. Right, but what the rabbis are telling us are, here's a way of becoming a better person, don't talk so much. Right? It's better to be silent than to be talking. Okay, so there are four types. Let's just review. There are four types of mitzvahs d'rabbanan. There are takanos, which are things that the rabbis said that we must do. Right? There are gzeros, there are actions that are prohibited from us for doing. There are minhagim, which are actions that we have to do, but unlike takanos, were started by the people and then legislated by the Sanhedrin, okay? And then there are philosophical lessons, which are things that perfect us, make us better people, but are not obligatory, okay? Now, how does a rabbinic law become instituted? How do you get a rabbinic law, right? How does the actual process work that something becomes a mitzvah derabbanan? Could you have a mitzvah derabbanan today, right? Because how does it work? So the answer is that they had a discussion in the Sanhedrin, and then they would have a vote. Somebody would bring it up, hey, I think Kiddush on Shabbat morning is a great idea. And then they would discuss it, they would debate it, right? And then they would take a vote on it. And then however the vote came about, that's how the law became a law, okay? A simple majority would institute the law, okay? So that's how. So let's review, that's the end of section two. Let's review Mitzvahs D'Rabbanan, okay? Mitzvahs D'Rabbanan are the purpose of them. Is in order to ensure the observance of the mitzvahs d'oraisa. Okay, the people authorized to do this are the Sanhedrin. The one that authorized the Sanhedrin is God. Okay, God authorizes them. There are four different types of mitzvahs d'rabbanan: takanos, gzeros, minhagim, and philosophical lessons. Right, takanos are things that we must do. Gzeros are things that we're prohibited from doing. Right, and minhagim are things that are that the people created and then were instituted later by the Sanhedrin. And philosophical lessons are make us better. And the laws are instituted by way of a discussion in the Sanhedrin and then a vote. Right, and then the vote that becomes the law at that point. Okay, so that's a mitzvah d'rabbanan. Unlike a mitzvah d'oraisa, which is a Torah law. Right, so like we discussed in section one. The mitzvahs that are abundantly we discuss here, if there's a doubt about them, will generally be more lenient, right? If there's a doubt or there's a room to be lenient because they're only instituted by the rabbis. So for instance, when it comes to all the prohibitions on Shabbat that are d'oraisa, we can't break those unless it's for a life-saving reason, right? You can't just come along. But when it comes to d'rabbanan, But the rabbis, when they instituted each law on Shabbat, on a rabbinic law, when they made up those laws on Shabbat, they said that they don't apply b'makom tzar, in a time of pain. Okay, so for instance, if you're in pain, and you can alleviate the pain by violating a mitzvah d'rabbanan, many times you can. So for instance, the rabbis made a gzera that you can't take medicine on Shabbat. Why can't you take medicine on Shabbat? Because what we're worried about is that the way medicine used to be done was grinding. Grinding is a Torah prohibition, so you can't do that, okay? So today, right, they were not allowed to take medicine on Shabbat. But if we're in a significant amount of pain, not a little, I have a small headache, that doesn't count, but if I'm in a significant amount of pain, right, so then taking medicine wouldn't be a Torah prohibition, it would only be a rabbinic prohibition, right? And therefore, in a place of pain, it doesn't apply. So therefore, I'd be allowed to take medicine on Shabbat. That's not true if I'm in pain, that I'm allowed to violate a Torah law on Shabbat. Right? That would be, so that's an example of the difference. Okay, so we're going to move on to part three here. Okay, part three talks about the limitations of codification. I'm going to explain what that means. The elasticity of halacha and machlokas. This is where most of the confusion resides. Okay, so we've laid our groundwork and our foundation for the different parts of halacha, the mitzvahs d'oraisa, mitzvahs d'rabbanan, okay, Torah Shabbat Peh, Torah Shabbat Chtav. And now what we're going to start talking about is the actual application of these laws and the limitations of applying it. Okay, so a meta question that we would have for this section is, could it be possible that Moshe taught laws related to situations that couldn't occur until the technology was developed millennial later? Right, so could Moshe Rabbeinu have taught a lesson about driving cars on Shabbat? Right, so it would seem to be no. Okay, so that's a meta question that we're going to have. Okay, so what are the inherent limitations of any codification? Codification is the creating of a legal system, the writing down of laws. Okay, so you start a club. Okay, you and your friends start a club, and you say, okay, there's going to be a member of this club. There are certain laws, and you start writing down the laws of be a member of this club. Okay, so halacha is a codification. Halacha has been codified. I shouldn't say that halacha itself is not a codification, but let's say when people write down laws, right, the Torah is a codification. As soon as we write down laws inside a Sefer Torah, we've now begun a codification. The Rambam was a codification, right? The Mishnah Torah that the Rambam wrote was a codification, okay? The Torah was a codification. The Shulchan Aruch was a codification, okay? So there's limits. What's the limit to any time you want to write down a series of laws? The laws are limited, right, to whatever you've written down. If a new situation develops that you hadn't thought of, your book doesn't address the situation, right? So if your club had a law that said that you could only wear white shirts, right, but then you go to a country where you're not allowed to wear white shirts, and you look in your book and say, well, now I'm not going to wear a white shirt. Am I out of the club or not? Because I'm stuck in that situation. So that's the limitation of any codification. Anytime you write things down, right, you're always going to be limited to the words that you wrote down and the situations that you can think of. It's impossible to create a work that addresses every single situation that will ever occur. Right? That's an impossibility. Okay? The amount of situations that could possibly occur are more numerous than anything you could possibly write down. Okay, so if that's the limitation of any codification, and the Torah Shebichtav is a codification, so now what happens in a situation where a situation comes up that hasn't been discussed in previously written down laws? Okay, so what do we do now? How does the Torah tell us to address a new situation? Right, somebody invents the car, and now I want to know, can I use this on Shabbat? So what's the method by which we're able to do it? So the Torah has a method, right? We are to bring the question to Beis Din, okay? And if the local Beis Din did not know the answer, or they didn't feel adequately knowledgeable to give an answer, so they would kick it up to the next Beis Din, to the next Beis Din, to the next Beis Din, until you got to the Sanhedrin HaGadol in Yerushalayim, and they would be the ultimate deciders on any single issue, okay? So it would go to a vote in the Sanhedrin. So any new situation, any new technological advancement, anything that's not directly listed in the Torah that we don't have a consensus on what to do, would go to the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin would vote on it, and that would then become the law. That would then become part of the corpus of Torah Shebaal Peh. Okay? Got it? Okay, now, what did the Sanhedrin draw upon to decide what the law is. Right? You can't just be the Sanhedrin saying to themselves, well, I think this is a good idea, that's a good idea. There has to be a method that the Sanhedrin uses to make these decisions. Right? That's the what's that method? So what books, ideas, materials, what would the rabbis use to prove their points or disqualify their colleagues' points during deliberations? Right? What would they say? What would they use? Right? So, well, okay, so they would use the Torah, they would use Psukim, okay? And they would use previous generations of rabbis from previous generations' discussions. So they had notes on the previous generations' discussions. So they would use those as points to consider, and they would bring them up as proofs and say, well, because of this halacha that we had from, you know, from 400 years ago when Rabbi X decided this area of law, right, and he had this opinion, so therefore now we're going to use that and apply it here, okay? That they couldn't just come up with, well, I think it's this, right? They had to bring a proof to what they were saying or some rationale from previous halachas that were developed. So now, how did the judges, right, deliberate about the matter, right? What do they base their decisions on? Okay, so they base their decisions on Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh, especially the laws that they were taught in Torah Shebaalpeh, the methods of deriving laws, and the principles, right? That's what they would use to decide what should happen, okay? That's the idea. So let's say nobody ever thought of asking the question of, do I put my talus on first or my tefillin on first? Right? Let's say nobody had ever thought of that question. So they go to the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin would sit there and say, oh, well, you should put your tefillin on first because tefillin is more chashuv. It's more more important than tzitzis, right, for whatever reason, right? Somebody would say, and then somebody else would say, no, but we have a concept of tadir v'sheino tadir, tadir kodem. That principle takes precedence over all other principles, right? And therefore, this mitzvah would take precedence because we wear our talis more than we wear our tefillin. So that's something that they would call upon, okay? Now, this is a very important term I want you to use to understand, because this term, and with this we're going to end section 3, right, this term is used colloquially, meaning in slang, it's used differently than the actual meaning of it, okay? Psak halacha. What is psak halacha? Okay, so psak halacha is the decision of the Sanhedrin that's instituted into law. Okay, and that's a very serious matter. When the Sanhedrin makes a decision, it's not their opinion now. Okay, it's the individual members of the Sanhedrin might have had an opinion, but the Sanhedrin itself, when it comes up with an opinion, okay, so that opinion now becomes part of the law. There's a very serious practical ramification of psak halacha. Okay, and I'll explain. No, that's all. One second. I mean, if you have a what's called a zakei mamre. Okay, let's imagine you have a vote in the Sanhedrin and it's very close. Okay, it's 41-30. Right, so you have 30 chachamim who are the greatest of their generations. Right, these are not slouches. These are, right, the top 70 scholars of the generation. 30 of them disagree with the Sanhedrin's psak. Okay, so if those 30, let's imagine they didn't all come from Yerushalayim. They all served on the Sanhedrin Yerushalayim, but I imagine some came from Tzvat, some come from Netanya, some come from Tveria, right? And then what happens on Shabbat? They probably go home, right? During the week they're in Yerushalayim, and then on Shabbat they go home. So you would imagine that as one of the top 70 scholars, when they came home, it was a very big deal. And you'd imagine that when they came home on Shabbat, they'd give a shiur to their community, right? They'd teach Torah to their community. And you'd imagine that the topic that they would give a shiur on was the most popular topic that week in the Sanhedrin, and they would review what the deliberations were, okay? Now imagine if you're part of the minority and you believe firmly that these 30, right, that the 30 people that voted along with you were correct, and you believe that the 40 made a mistake, right? And you firmly believe that. So you would then give the shear. It would be permissible for you to say in the minority vote, listen, I felt that the majority was wrong. That's permissible to say. It's permissible to say I was part of the minority and I still feel that I'm correct. Okay, this is what I felt. If, though, this Zakein, this member of the Sanhedrin, then went ahead and told the people, and I'm so convinced I'm right, I'm telling you not to follow the Sanhedrin's law, but instead to follow the minority opinion, he's put to death. That's the significance of psak halacha. When something becomes psak halacha, when the Sanhedrin comes up with a decision, That is part of halacha, just like any other halacha in the Torah. Okay? There is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. There's no, it was a close vote, so you can do either one. It's psak halacha. We don't look at the other opinion as anything now but academic. Okay? We can study the other opinion in order to understand the Torah, but we cannot at all follow it practically. Okay, so that's the end of the section on the limitations of codification, elasticity of halacha, and machlokas. And right, so now we understood our meta question when we began was, could Moshe Rabbeinu have addressed a new case? And if he couldn't have addressed a case that wasn't going to come up, then how do we handle it? Right. So we talked about that every codification has inherent limitations to it in the fact that it can't address new situations or technological advancements. Okay, when a situation comes up that hasn't been discussed in previous laws, then Jews would go to the Beis Din, and the Beis Din would deliberate and then come up with an answer. In order to come up with an answer, they would rely on previous rulings or psukim in the Torah, okay, and they base their decisions on Torah Shebaal Peh and Torah Shebichtav. And the Torah Shebaal Peh, they would use the laws, the methods of deriving laws, and the Torah's principles in order to come up with an answer. And that gave us psak halacha, that the decision of the Sanhedrin is considered psak. It's considered, right, the definitive halacha, and you cannot go ahead and argue against it in a practical matter. That becomes part of halacha. All right, so part four, okay? Now the question becomes, this is our meta question, okay, for the section four, which is the system, God, and halacha. If Hashem only gave one Torah, how could we have debates? Right, where does the debate come from? God said, here's the law. Why would we ever have a debate in law? That's the meta question, okay? So there's a phrase in the Torah, lo b'shamayim hi. Okay, and that's going to be our key pasuk for this section. It means that it's not in the heavens. Okay, so that what that pasuk teaches us on a meta level is that the decision of practical halacha doesn't fall to God; it falls to us. We're the ones that decide practical halacha, not God. Okay, that's a powerful statement. It means that when God gave us the Torah, He said the Torah is now yours. Okay, and there's a story in the Gemara that teaches us the application of the principle of Loba Shemayimi. Okay, the Gemara goes, and the details of the story aren't important now. The discussion is a machlokas between the Chachamim and one of the rabbis about whether or not an oven is tahor or tameh, and the rabbi wants to prove that he's correct. He's convinced beyond any doubt, and a shadow of a doubt, that he's right in the halacha, and that all the other chachamim are incorrect. And he says, if I'm right, let the walls of the Beis Medrash start shaking. Let the wind bring down a tree, right? And he brings up all these metaphysical signs, these miraculous signs of things that nature wouldn't bring as a proof. And then eventually he says, let God himself say that I'm right. And a bas kol of a heavenly voice comes out and says that he's right against the chachamim. And what's the chachamim's answer? Right? We don't paskin by God. We don't listen to God. The halacha lo b'shamayim hi, it wasn't given to God. We determine halacha based on a majority vote. The majority has voted, and it's not in accordance with what you said. The fact that you're able to produce all these scary miracles doesn't affect the practical halacha. That's not part of the process. Okay, so what are we aiming for when we try to determine halacha in any given case? We're trying to keep in line with the system. That's the most important thing, okay? With previous halacha, with the methods and the principles. That's what's important. We're not trying to understand what God wants. As interesting as that is, and as counterintuitive as that is, we're not trying to understand what God wants when it comes to halacha, okay? What we're trying to understand is what does the system dictate? God gave us a system, which we described previously, right, of how we use Torah Shebaal Peh and Torah Shebichtav to deliberate and then come to a decision. That's now up to us to then use that system, and as long as we stay loyal to the system, we're doing what God has asked us to do. Okay, so it would make sense if we didn't have this, right, that the ultimate arbiter for halacha would have been a prophet. Right, I didn't know what the halacha is. I'll go to a prophet, and the prophet will ask God. Right, that would seem to have made the most sense. But now we understand, and the Rambam talks about this emphatically, that a prophet cannot rely on their prophecy to determine the halacha. A prophet can take part in halachic discussions, but he can't use prophecy to determine the halacha. He can't. If a prophet would go ahead and say, well, there's a debate here about whether or not you should wear a talit after sunset. I'm not sure what to do. I asked God, and God said this. We would immediately know that that prophet was a false prophet, because that's not what prophecy is for. Okay, that's the idea. And I'll just give you a quote from the Rambam that he says in his introduction to the Mishnayos. You should know that prophecy is ineffective in explaining the Torah and in deriving halachot from the principles. What Yehoshua and Pinchas learned was accomplished via in-depth learning and utilizing logical analysis, which is precisely the exact same thing that Ravina and Ravashi did in the Gemara, which did not use prophecy. Okay? So what role does God play in the halakhic process? Do we care what God thinks? Right? So the answer is that we're challenged to use our minds to understand the halakha. It's as if Hashem has given us the Torah and told us to understand what He wants. How do we do that? We use our minds to use the system of halacha to then come out and understand what the halacha is. Okay? So what's the only arbiter, what's the only metric, I should say, of deciding whether halacha, of knowing whether halacha is correct or incorrect when somebody tells you? Not God. Can't be God, because God doesn't play a role. So, no, because we're talking about a case where I wouldn't know. So the only metric is whether or not I was loyal to the system. If I came to you and said, this is how I derived the halacha. This is, you came to me and you said, I'm not sure what to do. What should I do? And then I told you, this is what I think you should do. And say, well, that seems strange. How did you come to that decision? As long as I showed you that I used the system of halacha, then you know that I'm right. It doesn't matter if that's the only measurement of right or wrong. Because there is no objective right or wrong, right? There is no book up in Shemayim that has halachos for in doubt and be like, I can't believe they're doing this, they're wrong, right? The only way of knowing if something is right or wrong, okay, is if you're using the system, okay? That's the right? So, and how do you have a debate, right? So a debate comes along because people have different ways of using their minds. Okay? And since their minds operate in different ways, when they apply it to the system, okay, what happens? They come up with different answers. But that's okay. They're both correct answers, even though they are diametrically opposite. One person says prohibited, one person says permitted. They are both correct, as long as they stuck to the system. If somebody came along and said, well, here's how I derived my answer. The pasuk says the following. Right, the Mishnah says this, right? Ravina says this, and based on that, I came up to the following answer. He said, great, and you, how did you come up to the answer? Last night I had a dream, and God came to me in the dream and told me this was the answer. So you'd say, okay, you are incorrect. They could very well be right if they had studied the sugya. But by definition, they're incorrect because they're not staying loyal to the system. So anyone that comes up with a law, but is that law is not derived by using our traditional system of developing laws, that by definition they are incorrect, no matter what they said. Right? Okay, that's why you can have debate. Right? Even though we had, remember our mega question was, if there was only one Torah given on our Sinai, how could you have debate? Debate stems from new situations, new technological advancements that were not listed in the Torah because, like we mentioned, the limitations of codification. Then you had two chachamim that look into the system, apply the system, but see the system applying in two different ways because their minds have taken them to two different approaches, but both sticking loyal to the system, right? And then coming along and saying their answer can be a legitimate debate. Many times one of the scholars will turn to the other scholar and say, listen, I think that you applied the system incorrectly, okay? That's his opinion. The other rabbi will say, no, I don't think that's true. Okay? Right? That's the idea. So I'll give you an example of where you could have such a situation. Let's imagine a woman comes to a rabbi and says, do I have to pray mincha every day? Is that an obligation? Okay? And one rabbi would say, yes, you have an obligation to pray mincha. And another rabbi would say, Well, I don't know, because davening, tefillah, prayer, is a time-bound mitzvah. You have to do it every single day. So, and therefore, as a woman, you're exempt. So the other rabbi could say, well, I don't see tefillah as time-bound. It's not actually time-bound, right? And therefore, their debate now centers around the application of the principle of what generates a mitzvah, time or a different obligation, right? That's an example of where you could see both rabbis sticking loyal to the system, but seeing different ways of understanding something, okay? Now, there are rabbis that stay loyal to the system, but make horrific mistakes because of ignorance, right? And there could be, let's say, a Gemara or someone else that said something that so clearly contradicts what they said, and they don't realize there are mistakes. You can still make mistakes, right? But the idea here is that you must stay loyal to the system, okay? And that God now doesn't play a role. So we're not, if somebody would come to you and say, should we be concerned what God would want in this situation? The answer would be no, right? Number one, because we can't figure out what God wants, and number two, because that's not what the system is. What God told us was to keep the system. Okay. All right. So to start part five, we're going to talk about practical contemporary halacha today. Okay. So today, we do not have a Sanhedrin. So our meta question starting off this subject is, without a Sanhedrin, how do we decide practical halacha today? Okay, that's the question. The way the system is designed, it's designed for us having a Sanhedrin. But if we don't have a Sanhedrin, then we're kind of stuck with not being able to keep a law. Okay, so how do we have psak halacha today? So psak halacha can only come from the Sanhedrin. So today we don't have a Sanhedrin, so we cannot have psak halacha. Let me make that clear. Okay, when somebody talks about what's the psak or how did he paskin, they're talking colloquially. They're using slang. But they can't discuss actual psak because psak would only be from the Sanhedrin. So if we're going to use technical terms that are correct and make sure that we're using the right terms, so today instead of psak halacha, we have something called nihug. Okay, and this is important. Nihug. Nun, yud, hey, gimel. Okay, nihug, nun, hey, vav, gimel. Nihug, okay? And this is where every Jew is obligated. Okay? It's mentioned twice in Pirkei Avos. Every Jew is obligated in a selecha rav, in designating a scholar that they say will decide the practical halacha for me. Okay? So, in this, and then that practical scholar will use the exact same method that the Sanhedrin used to decide their opinion. Okay? Now, as long as a Jew asks a legitimate scholar their question, and the legitimate scholar used the system, then the Jew is doing the correct thing. Okay? Each scholar is trained by their teacher in a different method that they've been taught on how to decide halacha. Okay? Right? So one school of thought might put more emphasis on, let's say, ideas in the Gemara, and other scholars might put more emphasis on what the common custom has been for the last couple hundred years. Okay, those are two different approaches. So you'll have different approaches among what we have today are rabbis that decide halacha. Okay, so does precedent play a role? Okay, that's our question when it comes to practical halacha today. Can a scholar disagree today in our times? Can a scholar disagree with something that a rabbi said back 2,000 years ago? Okay, that's a very big question. Okay, that's a very important question. How much does precedent play a role? Okay, so a scholar has to take into account what the Gemara says and cannot disagree with it. That is something that everybody agrees with. Okay, there's no disagreement within the true Torah Orthodox traditional world that you can ignore. Nobody would say you could ignore the Gemara. Okay, you couldn't take a pasuk on your own and decide based on the fact that the pasuk says this, I'm going to decide halacha. You must take the discussions of the Gemara into account. Okay, works and opinions given after the Gemara, okay, should also be taken into account. How much they're taken into account, the words of the Gaonim, the words of the Rishonim, the words of the Achronim, how much those are taken into account, all depends on the weight and the tradition that each scholar has taken from their rabbis. Some scholars that decide halacha will put great emphasis on what rabbis of previous generations have said. Others not so much. Right? Some people will say, if the Chavetz Chaim said something, we must follow the Chavetz Chaim. Who are we to disagree with the Chavetz Chaim? Okay, he said it, that's it. Other people will say the Chavetz Chaim was a great, was a great Talmid Chacham, but he's not the Rambam, right? So we don't have to listen to the Chavetz Chaim. That depends on who your posek is, okay? So for instance, the Mishnah Berurah in his introduction to his work, right, the Chavetz Chaim's introduction to his work talks about how much weight must be given to the Vilna Gaon, almost to the point where whatever the Vilna Gaon says, we must follow. Other people disagree with that approach, especially Sfarda. Right, and say, we don't have to listen to what the Vilna Gaon says. The Vilna Gaon was one of many different scholars. He was not anybody special that what he says goes. Okay, so those are two different approaches that we take to halacha. Okay, and how much precedence plays. Okay, now, how do different communities have different observances? Right? How do Ashkenazim and Sephardim have different observances? Right? So this is because traditions were developed in lands with different methods of deciding halacha. Okay, and again, Sephardim put certain weight on certain scholars' opinions, right? The Rambam, the Rashba, the Ramban, and Ashkenazim put emphasis on different Rishonim, on Tosfos, on Rashi, right? They put emphasis on their opinions. So that's how Ashkenazic and Sephardic communities started having a discrepancy of different practices and different customs. Okay, and those developed over the years. So who decides the Nihug today? Right, again, we don't have Pesach. Pesach is given by the Sanhedrin. So who decides the Niyug today? Who comes along and is the authoritative figures, the Sanhedrin of today, that can decide what we do today in a case of new advancement? Okay? And the answer is that there is no authoritative body. Great scholars can decide halacha. Okay? Because halacha isn't an accumulation of sources with a simple sample of where different opinions fall, right, with the majority deciding. Right, certain opinions carry more weight and importance than others. Okay, it's not enough just to have the ingredients, like when it comes to baking a cake, right? But you need the instructions as well. Okay, so that's today. Okay, so if you have a simple question, what bracha do I make on a lollipop? You don't need the greatest scholar to answer that question. What the niyug is today. But if you have a question of should I pull the plug on a person that's no longer breathing? Right, that you don't want to go to your local rabbi in yeshiva who just came out of smicha. Right, that you're going to want to go to a great posek. In my opinion, the determination of a great rabbi and a not great rabbi is level of humility versus arrogance. Okay, the rabbis that I consider great are the rabbis that would not answer the big questions themselves. They would have the humility to say, I don't know that answer. I need to ask somebody else. In my mind, that's always the arbiter between great rabbis and not so great rabbis. Not so great rabbis are more willing to answer big questions themselves, as opposed to saying, you know what, I have my own opinions on that area, I studied that area, but this is to determine the niyug, I want to go to somebody else. Okay, that's always, if you ask a rabbi a question and they say, this is a sort of counterintuitive, because you would want a rabbi that would be able to answer all your questions. Right, but if you go to a rabbi and the rabbi says, you know what, let me get back to you. I'd like to discuss this with somebody who knows more than me. That should be confidence building in your rabbi. That should be something that you say, oh, that's great. I'm glad that they have that humility. Okay, so you can't decide halacha for yourself unless you yourself are a scholar. Right, the fact that you studied some books and you studied in yeshiva for a couple of years and you know the Shulchan Aruch doesn't mean you can decide halacha yourself. When I got smicha, when I was ordained as a rabbi, so the Rosh Kolo or Uri Cohen would get up and say, "You now have the ability to tell somebody what it says in the Mishnah Berurah. You have been tested that you know the Mishnah Berurah well enough. If the case in particular is not described in the Mishnah Berurah specifically." That case is not described, you are not authorized to give an answer. The fact that you've studied the Mishnah Berurah and now can repeat what it says in the Mishnah Berurah doesn't mean that you now have the ability to go ahead and tell somebody what isn't said in the Mishnah Berurah. Right? How do you have, what gives you that authority? That's when you study the method of deciding halacha. That's a whole separate method. Some institutions teach that within smicha, some do not. Okay, Some people, and that comes to Shimush Rab. That's where you sit with a rabbi and you see how they go ahead and answer. That's learning the method of halacha. Okay, so let's go back. Today we don't have Psak Halacha. Let's review, because Psak Halacha is only in the Sanhedrin. Okay, we don't have the Sanhedrin today, so we can't have Psak Halacha today. Instead, we have Nihug. Nihug is where your personal rabbi, okay, comes along and says, this is what we observe. Now, there are great rabbis that are the rabbis of many communities, right? So this year, we had the privilege of having Rav Schechter speak to us. Rav Schechter can determine Nihug for many different communities, because many different communities respect his opinion. But it's the fact that they've accepted his opinion. Rav Moshe Feinstein gave a well-known interview for the New York Times, and they asked him how he became the scholar of the generation in America. And he said it was very simple. People came to me and asked me a question. They liked the answer. They told their friends that this person gives good answers. And more people came to me. It's essentially a popularity contest where the people accept, not that they like your answer because it's a good answer, but they recognize that you are a scholar and qualified to answer. And it's not the average guy in the street that's asking, but it's other great rabbis recognize the fact that he's on a different level. Okay? That's why when you find, again, people who are nowhere near the level of scholarship of what we call the Gedolei Hador, the greats of our generation, okay, and they come along and say, well, I can disagree with them. What are they? Okay, they know a little more than me, but I've also studied the area. That's when you recognize that that arrogance is ludicrous and goes against the entire, it undermines the entire system of halacha. Okay, so that's, right, that's, so different communities have different observances, okay, because it depends on how much weight they put on precedence. Okay, as we talked about, precedence does play a role, but right, so you have to look into the Gemara, but after the Gemara, none of the opinions after the Gemara are definitive that they have to be taken into account, but different traditions will take into account different weights of scholars as the generations go on, and today, only a scholar that's sufficiently qualified can decide the Nihug today. It can't just be the average guy on the street. The next part is part 6, Chumras, Kulos, and Customs. Okay, so let's discuss the meta question here. Okay, meta question is, if we know how to decide halacha, both during the time of the Sanhedrin and today, how do you have Chumros, stringencies, Kulos, leniencies, and what we call the colloquial minhagim, not the minhagim derabanan that we discussed before, but colloquial minhagim. Okay, so what's the difference, first of all, between a minhag of today and nihug? Okay. A minhag derabanan, like we talked about, right, which are what we talked about are actions that communities came up with and later instituted by the Sanhedrin. That's something else, right? But today's minhag are details of practice, okay? But they only associate with halachic practice. They're not actual halachos, okay? So it's not that there's an actual halacha of doing something, but they're associated with halacha. So there's no halacha of singing Shalom Aleichem on Friday night, right? But that could be your family's custom that they say Shalom Aleichem. Okay, that's the colloquial minhag. Okay, so we talk about customs and we talk about minhagim. They don't apply to halacha. Okay, so now let's discuss chumras. Okay, so when it comes to chumras, what's a chumra now? What's a stringency? Okay, so when two rabbis disagree, okay, and the nihug follows one opinion. Let's say there's a consensus. We have a debate among the Rishonim, and there's a consensus about the one opinion, okay? And the other opinion is more stringent. In other words, the consensus of the community has been to accept the lenient opinion. But you study the area, and you see that the stringent opinion has a lot of logic to it. It's very hard for you to see, well, I don't understand. Again, I'm not the greatest halachic scholar and the greatest decider, but I don't understand why we didn't go with the stringent opinion. Then it's you accept upon yourself to take on the practice of the other Rishon. Let's give an example here because it'll be easier for us to understand. When Shabbat ends, so you have two basic opinions when Shabbat ends. The consensus opinion, which is a certain amount of time, right, when three stars come out at night. And then you have Rabbeinu Tam, which is 72 minutes after Shkia, after sunset. Right? So the consensus is not like Rabbeinu Tam. We usually end early. But let's say you go through the sugya and you say, you know what, Rabbeinu Tam makes a lot of sense to me. I don't understand why we didn't. So you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to start keeping Rabbeinu Tam as a chumrah. What that means is that you're not accepting it upon yourself as your nihug. This is not to, this is not what I'm knowing to do, right? But I'm accepting it upon myself as a chumrah, as a stringency. And therefore, in an emergency case, let's say there's a flight that I have to take right after Shabbat, I don't have to keep Rabbeinu Tam. I didn't accept it upon myself as a halacha, as my niyug. I took it on as a chumrah, okay? Unfortunately, what we find is a lot of times people accept upon themselves chumras because they feel more religious because of it, right? That's an incorrect approach. That's not the traditional Judaism approach. The traditional Judaism approach of halacha, if you've noticed, we have never made mention of feelings, of fervor, of religious fervor. There's nothing wrong with religious fervor, and it's necessary as an Eved Hashem to have religious fervor, but fervor and feelings can't dictate halachic practice. Halachic practice must be dictated by the system. So within the system, if I feel that, if I understand a opinion that is more logical, right, I've come to the conclusion it's more logical, it's more stringent, then I'll accept upon myself a chumrah. So it's not that chumrah is to the contradiction of niyug, but what chumrah is an enhancement of niyug. Chumrah is where I see two logical opinions, the stringent one makes more sense to me, so I'm going to follow the stringent opinion. Okay? Akula. What's akula? Akula is the opposite of a chumrah. It's where there's a lenient opinion. Okay? So if two rabbis disagree, and Nihug follows the stringent opinion, but let's imagine now there's a mitigating factor which makes it incredibly challenging to follow the stringent opinion. So in that case, rabbis will allow you to follow the lenient opinion. Right, in a mitigating case, or in this mitigating circumstance, where the stringent opinion is difficult to follow, then the rabbis will say, okay, you can follow the lenient opinion in this one case because of a mitigating factor. That's not, again, contradicting the niyug, it's taking advantage of a lenient opinion in that case. And obviously, we are naturally biased towards following lenient opinions. Right, we would want to follow a lenient opinion. So in order to follow a lenient opinion, it pays to go to a scholar. Okay, so a chumrah and a kula, like we've discussed, are not directed by fervor or by emotion, but rather they're after studying a sugya and seeing the logic inherent in one opinion that's not the niyug, following that opinion, b'toras chumrah, but as a stringency only, is an acceptable practice. Okay, and a commendable one in certain situations, but again, shouldn't be done out of religious fervor. A kula is a lenient opinion which can be relied upon in a mitigating circumstance where the stringent opinion that's been accepted as the nihug widely by the community is difficult to follow. Then a rabbi would say, in this case, there's actually a kula, there's a lenient opinion that we could rely on in this case. All right, so the last thing that we're going to discuss is minhagim. Okay, so the minhagim today, and that's usually the most controversial of times where you find that people are confused as to what to do. Okay, and how do we go against minhagim? So things like kitniot, right? So kitniot is not a mitzvah from the Torah, right? Kitniot is not a mitzvah d'rabbanan. Okay, kitniot was a rabbi came along, a group of rabbis came along. After the finishing of the Gemara, right, either towards the end of the Rishonim's period of time or the early Achronim, and came along and said Ashkenazim can no longer eat certain types of vegetables and legumes for whatever reason. Okay, and that goes into we're not going to go into all of Kidneyah. So the question is, do I have to follow that? As an Ashkenazi today, can I just simply say, you know what? The Sephardi side makes a lot more sense. And assuming that you're a scholar, okay, let's assume that you're a scholar, you're not just some guy that wants to eat Kidneyahs. Right, but you're an actual scholar. So could an Ashkenazi Torah scholar today come along and say, I'm going to get rid of this custom that's been in Minhag Ashkenaz for 700-800 years? Right? In the previous discussions we've talked about, in the previous sections we've talked about the role of precedence. That based on your halakhic tradition, people put precedence on more things than others, right? So we talked about the difference between how much you put emphasis on the Mishnah Berurah versus the Vilna Gaon versus Sephardic rabbis versus Rambam and Rashi, right? Each tradition and Mesorah tradition has its own weights and values that it puts on things. So how about today? How would you go about doing this? Okay, so that's the question. So the Rif has an interesting tshuva. Okay, and the Rif says that Ikar HaMinhog She'osin Apiv V'hu She'rov HaKal Yis'atzu M'ziknei HaKal V'yiknu T'chana K'mashe She'yitknu V'yikaymu Asa Zehu HaMinhog. Okay, so he defines a minhog as something that the majority of the congregation has, when consulting the elders of the congregation, has come up with this law that they've put into place. That's the minhog. And even he says, Achar Shanim Im lo yodu hachi karo. Let's say you look back and you're like, I have no idea why we do this. It doesn't make any sense to us. Right? We've been doing this thing for a couple hundred years, but we have no idea why. Elo shahaya machzik b'kach, but we've been doing it. Right? Everybody's religiously been doing this, but we cannot, for the life of us, figure out why. We've gone through all the sources, we've gone through everything, we don't know why. Right? V'haya omei b'cheskaso. It doesn't matter. Says the Rif, if it's been done for hundreds upon hundreds of years, or however long, he doesn't give an example, but if it's been done for many, many years, that becomes the minhag. And even if we don't know why, right, which is antithetical to almost everything we know about Torah learning, right, which is, and keep in mind, the Rif lived in the year 1000, so it wasn't that many years between the finishing of the Gemara in the year 3-400 and the Rif's time in the year 1000, so even then the Rif had said that we must keep the Chazakah. The Rashba came along, okay, the Rashba, and agrees with the Rif. Okay, so he says, Stam min hagim kol shein neged hadin, anosim bem din, v'lo amro al minhag mevat alacha. But he puts on one qualification, and he says that if the minhag is against the din, we don't follow the minhag. Right, so you could get rid of a minhag if you find that it goes against halacha. Okay, if you have a minhag that goes against halacha, that you can do. Okay, let me be clear, you would not follow the minhag. So what gives the power to minhag? Right? Why is it that we would follow minhag? And the answer has to be, right, because it's the only thing that fits into our system that we've discussed until this point, is aseh l'charav. That there has to be a global aseh l'charav. That the halacha isn't just aseh l'charav that I ask my personal rabbi, but there also must be a concept of a global aseh l'charav, where the community as a whole has done something, and that through the power of aseh l'charav, because originally the minhag developed by asking chachamim, we've kept that minhag, and what it would take to dissolve that minhag would have to be a mass amount, a consensus by the entire congregation that the time of this minhag has ended. Right? That's the only thing, and we don't have such a case. There's nothing that you could look at, I don't know of one, I'm not familiar with one, of where the entire Klal Yisrael comes along together and says, this thing is no longer applicable today. So when you have, and this is what I think the logic of the Rif is, what you have is when the Rif says that something that's been going on for many, many years is accepted widely by the congregation, and even though we don't know the reason, you still must keep it, there must be this concept of a global aseh l'charav, of a global following your rabbi's decision, and even though it's not your personal rabbi, so the individual scholar must have the humility to recognize the fact that this global concept of aseh l'charav precludes that individual scholar from coming along and changing the accepted practice. And that's what minhag is. So how practically would it happen that you would have today, nowadays, a minhag that's dissolved? You would have to go from community to community, getting the leading rabbis of each and every community, the Yemenite community, the Sephardic community, the Moroccan community, the Ashkenazic Hasidic community, the Ashkenazic Lithuanian community. You'd have to get all the leading rabbis of all these communities to go ahead and say, okay, you know what, this minhag, whatever it might be, we're going to dissolve it now. They couldn't do that with a minhag d'rabbanan, with even a din d'rabbanan, a minhag d'rabbanan, or a mitzvah d'oraisa, obviously. But it came to a custom that was developed well after the Gemara, and has just been a custom. So you'd have to get the consensus of the leading scholars in order to do this. One scholar coming along and saying, I think this is correct, is not enough to go ahead and do it. And why generally do they not go ahead and dissolve halachos like this? Right? For the very simple reason that broad shoulders. They don't feel they have the great wisdom of rabbis of previous generations. To go against rabbis of previous generations and say that, you know what, I think I know more than them, is a big statement on their part. And most rabbis don't have the audacity or the arrogance to go ahead and say such a thing. So I would say that the minhag today is almost synonymous with nihug, in the fact that they're both authoritative, and you're not going to be able to just simply get out of them. The only difference is that your nihug, your personal nihug, your local rabbi who you go to, the one that you've decided and designated as your rabbi, he's the one that can make that decision. Okay, let's just sum up now from all the way from the beginning. Okay, let's go through very, very quickly all the big bullet points. Okay, we talked about how the mechanics of halacha work. Okay, and this should now give you an idea of when somebody tells you this is a halacha, this is a din, you have to follow this law, it should give you an idea of why it is that you have to follow it, right? And what the idea is, okay? So we talked about what Moshe was taught at Har Sinai, that he was taught Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh. We talked about that the Torah Shebichtav had mitzvos and a narrative. We talked about the Targ mitzvos, 613 mitzvos, and that there are din daraisa, there are Torah laws as well. That the Torah Shebichtav can be broken down into mitzvos asay, mitzvos lot asay, and philosophical lessons. We talked about that the Torah Shebal Peh has three different parts to it. It has laws, the method of deriving laws, and principles that apply throughout the Torah. We talked about that the purpose of mitzvos darabanan are to ensure that mitzvos daraisas are kept, right? That the Sanhedrin, or the great body of rabbis in the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah at the time, were authorized to make mitzvos darabanan, and they were authorized by God. We talked about there are four types of rabbinic laws, takanos, gzeros, minhagim, and philosophical lessons, okay? And it takes a deliberation and a vote of the Sanhedrin, the majority, to establish a law. We talked about that any codification is inherently limited to the situations that are discussed. It can't discuss new technological advancements or new situations. Okay, we talked about that that when a situation comes up that hasn't been discussed or hasn't been codified, right, it would go to the Beis Din, who would deliberate it using past discussions of rabbis and principles and the laws and the methods of deriving laws. And Pesach Halacha is their decision, which then becomes part of the corpus of Halacha and cannot be disregarded and has just as much weight as any other Halacha. Okay, we talked about Lo B'Shamayim. He means that the Torah is not in the heavens, meaning that it's given to us. The story of the walls coming crashing down and all the miraculous signs didn't do anything because we're not trying to figure out what God wants. We're trying to figure out what the system dictates, and God doesn't play a role in the halachic process, which is why we don't go to prophets. And anybody is right as long as they're using the system. Okay, the halacha today. Okay, is not psak because we don't have a Sanhedrin. It's niug. It means you go to your local rabbi that you designate, right, who you believe is a scholar and can decide halacha, and they go ahead and tell you. They use precedent depending on their tradition of deciding halacha, how much weight precedent is used, but precedent is used, especially in the Gemara, must be used. And different communities today have different observances, right, especially Ashkenazim and Sephardim, because traditions have developed differently based on how much weight has been given to previous scholars. Today, nihug is any qualified scholar can tell you nihug. Okay, that's today. You can only decide halacha for yourself if you're a qualified scholar. We talked about chumros and kulos, and chumros are when you go through a sugya logically and you see logic to a side that's not accepted widely in nihug, you decide to take it on as a chumra, not as halacha. And a kulos is where you rely on something that a lenient opinion when mitigating circumstances. And we talked about today's minhagim that are not halacha. The example we gave was kidneyos. We must keep even if we don't understand the halacha until we have a consent. I mean, even if we don't understand the reasoning behind it, until we have a consensus by everybody. As a final word, to conclude this, now we can understand why it is that seemingly outliers in the rabbinic world give a psak that people find is so different than everything else, where the line is drawn between do we accept that halacha or do we not? When you have certain people that are well past the point of chidushim, but into the realm of undermining classic halacha, why they're rejected by other rabbis. So the reform movement and the conservative movement, for sure, we can see, understand why they were rejected, right? Because they were not loyal to the system. It wasn't that they came up with the wrong answers. It was, by definition, their answers were wrong because they didn't use the system. The reform movement and the conservative movement got rid of the system, right? The conservative movement to a lesser extent, but there were certain parts of the system. So an example is the conservative responsa that allows driving to shul on Shabbat. So what's the logic that they used? Okay, why do they allow it? So they said that what would God rather us do? Stay at home or go to the synagogue on Shabbat? So that, by what we studied here, we see that that's not an acceptable way of approaching halacha. Because you can't ask what God wants, because we're not trying to determine what God wants in halacha. That's not, so that's the fault in the conservative system, which is why Orthodoxy has rejected conservative psak and conservative halacha, okay? And reform movement, well, the more so because they've gotten rid of the entire concept of divine, right? And that the laws are divine in that sense. So that's the main point, is the mechanics of halacha follows a system, and in order to follow halacha properly and come up with the right, correct approach to halacha, one must be loyal to the system.